On Saturdays, on Canton Road in Hong Kong, a file of mainland Chinese women gather outside a shop selling luxury goods. Such is the demand, or at least so goes the rumour, that they are restricted to buying not more than 10 handbags each. How should we respond to such a desire for luxuries? Be appalled, smile in a slightly superior way, express pity, or acknowledge that the newly wealthy always want luxuries? When the poor have the choice between culture and luxury, they always choose luxury first. Not a comment from a Prada or Gucci exec, but the words of Thomas Hardy in the late 19th century. It certainly looks to be the case, with a 35% growth in such goods in China in 2011, a mere 10% in recession-hit Europe in the same year. Well, on the first weekday after the end of Lent, and in a world where the desire for luxury goods grows and grows, Nightwaves takes on luxury. Is the desire for luxury, whether goods or experiences, a sign that conspicuous consumption has taken over our heads and hearts with awful social consequences? Cue last summer's riots with their consuming passions. Or is the desire for luxury something that has complex and deep roots in many societies, past and present, an expression of social aspiration, even of social change? To discuss, I'm joined by two historians, Michael Scott, historian of the ancient times, and by Maxine Berger, historian of the 18th century. Down the line from Cornell, by Robert Frank, author of Luxury Fever, by Giles Fraser, now probably best known for resigning from St. Paul's over the Occupy movement and actually taking up a new residence as priest in Elephant and Castle, London, a rather less salubrious location than St. Paul's. And last but not least, by Chris Sanderson, co-founder of Future Laboratory, who also writes a column for Luxury Briefing. I want to bring everybody in, but I want to begin, if we can, by just trying to pin down a few things about luxury. And Chris, may I start with you? Tell me what for you is a luxury good.
I would define a luxury good as a product where the original function, or the primary function, is often superseded by extraneous addition.
Give me an example.
So a watch is something that many of us have and require, and you might need jewels within that watch to make it function and to make it work better. So jewels are often seen as a primary part of a complex watch or a well-made watch. But were I to add 24 three-carat cabochon diamonds to the surround of that watch, they don't actually help or aid the process of telling the time. They don't make the watch tell the time any better. If I need a new pair of winter boots, for example, I've probably got three primary requirements, which is that they keep me warm, they keep me dry, and they increase traction in bad weather. If I'm going to, say, Louis Vuitton to look at the new collection by Marc Jacobs for autumn winter 2012, I may not necessarily be thinking about those three requirements top of mind.
Okay, so I understand what they are. Why do we want them so much?
We've been through a period in the last 30 years in which we've seen the democratisation of luxury. So something that was once regarded purely as the pleasure or the reserve, the preserve of the haute bourgeoisie, is now something that is attainable to more and more of us. So that process was really begun in the mid-80s when our fashion industry changed from being something that was about suiting or clothing a very small group of people who had money in towns and cities who all wanted to look the same, to becoming a global industry that was about brand. So it was the same move towards brand. And it was at that point that it became an aspirational item that could actually be affordable, because it was suddenly a lipstick, or it was a belt or a pair of sunglasses.
Aspiration, democracy, those are not necessarily the first terms that people would think about when luxury is mentioned. You want to defend luxury against the claim that they ratify inequality by saying they're democratising.
Well, I'm not so sure that the democratisation of luxury has been a particularly good thing, either for the luxury industry or from an ethical standpoint. So I would by no means ratify it. it's happened. I think the question is sort of asking about the horse once it's actually left the stable. It's already happened. So we're in a situation where globally, and as you identified, I think, with your very neat, hardy quote, is often we have a preference for things that we simply cannot afford. And when we've been through a process of the last 30 years of what I would call deficit finance living, that most of us choose to live according to what we can borrow, not what we earn or indeed have, then again, the issue of whether luxury is right or wrong, I think, is really bigger than this idea of, you know, its kind of role in society.
OK, so my Methodist teachers who told me repentance is unlike innocence are right about these things. There's no way back. We can only go way forward. I wonder if I could bring the two historians in. Michael, from the point of view of kind of Greek culture, was luxury goods, were they important then?
Yeah, you don't need to look very far into the ancient Greek or Roman worlds to find that luxury is then, as now, a key issue for all the sorts of reasons that Chris has just outlined. One of the things that makes Greece particularly interesting, as an example, is that Greece was never Greece in the ancient world. It wasn't just one country. Actually, it was a bunch of city-states who spent most of their time fighting one another, but actually had really different takes on all sorts of cultural items, luxury being one of them. So, on the one hand, you had Athens, the founding city of democracy, sitting there worrying constantly about how to manage luxury. How do you, you know, take a democratic system where everyone's supposed to be equal and mar that with the problem that people just cannot ever always all
What would
be
a
equal.
Luxury good have been in Athens? I've got no idea.
It could be some of the very same kind of things. We're not talking watches encrusted with jewels, but we are talking about fine objects of manufacture, so craftsmanship, or it could be a rare material, or it could be the fact that it's travelled for thousands of miles. But interestingly, and one thing that hasn't come up so far, is it could also be a type of behaviour. So the Athenians loved representing their arch enemy, the Persians, as luxurious, behavioural kinds of people. And what that meant was that they were way too emotional, totally over the top, very effeminate. And there's a wonderful insult that you could throw at a sort of a luxurious person in Athens, which is to say that they were a tunic trailer, that they allowed their clothes to just sort of go along the floor and pick up dirt all the time, because no hardy Athenian would do that. And at the other end of the Greek spectrum are the Spartans, you know, of 300 fame. You know, the Spartans are Spartan. Our word tells you all you need to know about them. They absolutely banned every possible luxury from their own society. So there you are, in Greece, you've got both ends of the spectrum right there, and in the middle you've got the people in southern Italy and Sicily who were living the Dolce Vita, and you've got the Macedonian kings like Alexander the Great using luxury is as every king in history would have done as well.
Okay, Maxine, let's move to 18th century Britain. I know luxury was important then. How important was it?
Well, luxury was the debate of the century in the 18th century. It really defined the parameters, major parameters of the Enlightenment. The great text that opened so many of those debates was Mandeville's Fable of the Bees, and even better, his Search into the Nature of Society. And what he discussed here were the importance of the passions, and that we were all creatures of self-love. We were pleasure-seeking and vanity-ridden creatures. There was a lot of debate then that carried on about whether there was luxury was a good thing or a bad thing, whether there was old luxury or new luxury. Was it better to just consume at feasts and parties and dances, or was it better to accumulate nice things? Fine glassware, silver and gold objects, beautiful paintings.
Okay, who were the anti in the 18th century? Because you used the word vanity, which makes me think there must have been, there certainly was, since I've jokingly raised Methodists in the late 18th yes. century, there must have been a kind of Christian opposition to this.
Well, there was certainly a Christian opposition, but I think even more significant was the opposition that grows up amongst the Enlightenment philosophers themselves. There are those like David Hume who argued that luxury really wasn't so great, but it was kind of a second-best solution. It was better than war and lethargy. It really stimulated the quick march of the spirits and pushed us to manufacture more, to extend and expand the arts and civility. But then Rousseau comes along and says, this has just led to an enormous division in society, that we have these very rich, but lots and lots of very poor, just aspiring to this, moving to cities. And really, if we had a much more equal distribution of income and people lived on the land, we would have a much happier society.
Okay, well, let me ask to both historians to respond to this, then I'll broaden it out to include everybody else. As you listen, Michael, to the present debates, and you think historically, are there connections between the issues in ancient Athens or ancient Sparta or wherever and now?
I think two things have struck me thinking about that question and just the debate so far. The first is the debates we're having now. We had them in the 18th century and we had them in ancient Greece. And I'm sure you could go further back and you could go anywhere you like and you'd find those same debates.
And the Renaissance. Under Philip IV, Spain, we have all those discussions of splendour and magnificentia. I mean, it's just new forms of these.
The second, but you know, if luxury, as it seems to be, is something that is just part of human society, mm-hmm. I think the important thing that comes out of looking at the past and the connection between the past and the present is that no society has succeeded in banning it. Yeah. It's here, and as we said, it's here whether we like it or not. We have to actually now think about what can the past tell us about how to manage it. Best.
Yes, I mean, there were a whole series of sumptuary laws through the whole medieval and early modern periods. The Italian city-states held them. The whole purpose of them was to prevent people dressing like their betters or dressing to keep the social boundaries absolutely clear. But that became absolutely impossible. There were taxes on luxury goods, all sorts of attempts to keep out various types of luxury goods, some associated with the moral degradation of the poor, from tobacco and gin to tea. Now, you may think, well, maybe these really weren't luxury goods, but certainly for the poor at the time, they were. They became very addictive. They're addictive goods. That's another aspect that we could discuss.
OK, well, listen, we've conjured up a world where luxury is a kind of runs its way through societies from then, whenever then is, till now. Let's open it up now. I mean, Giles, you're shuffling on your chair. Giles Fraser, shuffling on your chair where all this is going on. Just respond to that from, as it were, what I might call within the Christian tradition. And I don't want you to speak for Christianity, which would be a nonsense request.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, there's a great archetype. There's sort of two archetypes that run through this discussion, and I call them roundheads and cavaliers. I mean, that's the sort of the thing. And Philip, you are definitely a roundhead. You're the sort of Methodist roundhead. I'm a sort of cavalier. Now, I think if you have two different attitudes to luxury, and it splits in different ways. If you're a roundhead, then when you think of luxury, you think of sin and you want to think of ethics. If you're a cavalier, when you think of luxury, you think of joy and you think of celebration and love and so forth. And it seems to me that there's fundamentally no peace to be had between the roundhead and the cavalier.
There is. You just cut off the king's head.
That won't stop luxury, though. That won't stop the march of luxury.
It came back.
Well, on that principle, Robert, I mean, you're living in America. You've written a book on luxury fever. How do you respond, particularly to Chris's issue at the beginning, which I think is also there rather seriously in Giles's comment about cavaliers and roundheads, which is the democratising principle, the aspirational principle behind luxury? Do you think it's been effective in the States?
It's nothing new. It's what stands out from what you and your circle are used to. So the idea that tea would count as a luxury, none of us would think of it as one, but at some point and in some circles, it was a luxury. It stood out from what people were ordinarily consuming. And I think that's always going to be part of society. It's not a bad thing. I think the roundheads are wrong to brand it as one, although there are so many negative consequences of the demand for luxury. There's joy in it. That's true. It does stimulate effort and get the juices flowing. It's probably responsible for a lot of the wealth that's been created over the last couple of centuries. But at the same time, the patterns of consumption that the demand for luxury spawns have led to just an enormous amount of waste. The good news at the end of the day is that we could steer some of that consumption to much more useful purposes without anybody having to give up any joy or purpose in
life.
Well,
since I've been cast as the roundhead, you sound to me, Robert, like the classic liberal on the one hand and on the other. A perfectly distinguished place to be. Chris, can you develop this, the worry you have about the democratising aspirational, that it's arrived but not in quite the way that anybody would want?
Well, I think the point has already been made for me with the example of tea, both from Maxine and Robert, which is that once precious object becomes normalised, it loses some of its allure, or it interestingly shifts, of course, into another frame of reference. I think it was Charlie Chaplin who said, "One of the saddest things I can imagine is to get used to luxury," which I completely concur. I concur with that comment. But at the same time, one of my luxuries in my day is still having a cup of tea.
No, that's to use luxury. It's to stretch luxury, isn't it?
But is
that's
it?
That's time.
But is it?
Sorry,
but,
Giles,
but
go
why
on.
Should luxury,
come on, Cavalier.
Why should luxury always be associated with excesses of wealth? So it doesn't.
Precisely.
You don't necessarily need to do that. So I remember as a kid, you know, the great luxury item for me, I mean, does this stretch it? Is when you'd have for curry and they would bring you gratuitously one of those little chocolates afterwards. And I would think, oh, this is just extraordinary. How wonderful. How sort of excessive. And there was a sort of luxury quality to this. Now it was simple, very cheap. It wasn't something that... And it brought great joy. So it wasn't about some great excessive wealth. I mean, there is a sense in which luxury also can be, you know, people wearing labels and people wanting to sort of, like, big themselves up in a socio-economic way. But that's not always the case.
I mean, the simple thing is if you look at the sort of classic treatises on hierarchy of needs, so somebody like Abraham Maslow writing in 1943 and identifying the stages through which you go through needs, from purely physiological to ones that are about safety to ones that are about a requirement for self-esteem, and then you arrive at this sort of, you know, nirvana of self-actualization. That also defines the different indices, if you like, of the way that we as individuals, as members of society, can engage with luxury, and some of it is purely about expense and value, and others, other times it's about poetry and it's about an emotional or spiritual requirement.
Yeah, let me just add, though, Giles' sentimental reminder of his childhood notwithstanding, there's an immense commodification. There is a global industry now that has changed your nice chocolate after your into a global industry that wants to penetrate all parts of the world, and that changes the game, Maxine.
I particularly like to respond to Chris's point about the luxury of having a bit of time for a cup of tea. Well, I think we should go back to look at John Maynard Keynes, who in 1929 predicted that we would all be working 15 hours a week. That would provide all we needed and even superfluities, but he did not predict the huge advance in all kinds of new commodities, a whole range of new qualities of commodities, possibilities of people looking for whole ranges of new fashion, the whole significance of the endless search for novelty, which lies behind that
Michael.
Search for luxury.
Michael, and then Robert.
I think there's something that brings these last two points and what you were saying, Philip, about the sort of luxury brands creating together. Mm. Right now, where we are now, some of the most interesting luxury products that are being created are not objects at all. Mm. They're creation of free time or creation of actual personal space, or interestingly, of something ethical or sustainable or environmental.
Can you give us an example?
Well, something like if you want to go and splash on your private jet and run off to a holiday island somewhere, the luxury good will now actually deliver that to you in something that is environmental and sustainable way. It's interesting that the sort of social pressures that luxury is now coming under are being fused into a new type of luxury which can be commoditized, which is actually not necessarily an object in the traditional sense at all.
Robert?
The Keynes observation that Maxine mentioned sort of missed the point that there's an aspect of the human brain that just has to have a frame of reference to make any judgment. If somebody asks you whether it's cold out today, you know, if you're in Helsinki and it's a 16 degree centigrade day, everyone's going to be out in their shirt sleeves celebrating the warm day. If it's in Miami, and it's 16 degrees centigrade, they'll all be bundled under blankets and wrapped up in their warmest coats. It's the same with goods. A good is a luxury or not, just according to whether it stands out from what we're accustomed to, and that will depend on who your social circle is, what the year is, what country you live in. All those things will matter.
But there are certain things, if not transhistorical, there are certain things that have shaped history. And I mean, Christianity is one of those. When you and I spoke earlier, Michael, you mentioned that you'd actually traced how Christianity had reformulated luxury.
Sure. I mean, if you look at luxury through the ancient Greek and Roman worlds, there is a fundamental breakpoint when Christian thinking enters the picture and luxury takes on the connotation of a sin. Where in the, you know, Christian thinking, it's easier for a rich man for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter, those sorts of things. And what you get in early medieval Britain is, you know, on the one hand, you get monks like St. Cuthbert sitting there absolutely denying every possible luxury there is. You get the big the kings and the potentates of medieval Britain consuming luxury, in the church stuck somewhere in the middle, having to find a way to negotiate this world. At the same time, I think one of the other things that factors into our discussion, hasn't really come up, is that luxury is about objects, but luxury also then has connotations for other things about your personality. And one of the things the Greeks did, for example, was if you went into the fish market and you picked a particular kind of expensive fish, that didn't just mean you liked expensive fish. That meant that you had a certain political leaning that sort of made you definitely anti-democracy and possibly, you know, there for a tyranny. So there's lots of luxury seeps everywhere.
I mean, Christianity is not... I mean, Christianity is ambivalent about luxury, which is... I mean, there's that great story in all the Gospels about Mary Magdalene pouring over the perfume over Jesus' head or Jesus' feet. It cost a year's wages, 300 denarii. Now there are people there who are scandalised by this. So what is this story about? I mean, all the endless sermons go, this is a story about love rather than about ethics. And love itself is excessive. You buy flowers. They're not purposeful in the way that, you know, they don't have that sort of utilitarian function. So you get this split between, as it were, love, which is has excess built into it, and ethics, which has a sort of more utilitarian sort of function. And
together. How does Christianity distinguish between what one might call good love and bad love?
Well, it finds it very difficult to distinguish between those two. So, for instance, worship, you know, the whole idea that you may have excess in worship, you jewelled vestments and you know, magnificent cathedrals and all of that sort of thing. But where does the point come when all of that luxury is itself, you know, corrosive? And I don't think Christianity... I think Christianity has found it very, very difficult to find the line there. But those are the issues.
I think Christianity is right to be ambivalent about all of this, because there really are two sides to it. Think about the CEO who wants to stage a special occasion for his daughter's 16th birthday. There's a standard in his circle. We had a CEO here in America a few years ago who staged a coming-of-age party for his daughter and spent $10 million on the affair. They had 300 of her closest friends gather in the Rainbow Room atop Rockefeller Center. They had Stevie Nicks play. They had 50 Cent play. All the headline acts were summoned to perform. All the children went home with, at that time, the must-have object of the day, a video iPod and $300 worth of other party favors. He was just trying to create a special occasion for his daughter, let's assume, but to do that in a certain circle of wealth requires spending more than people expect, doing something a little bit more lavish.
Okay, so come on, Robert, get off the fence. You've just described it. I want to know where you stand on this.
That I think it's grossly wasteful when you think about the process that leads to. Now others have to spend more. You see, I saw a clown going into a professor's housing unit in New York a couple of years ago. What's a clown going in there? I realized that it was some professor's 10-year-old must be having a birthday party, and now parents know that if you don't hire a magician or a clown, their children are going to be disappointed. So there's a certain waste to all that. The weddings in America now cost an average of $30,000 each. In 1980, the average was $11,000. Does anybody believe that the people getting married today are happier because the weddings are more expensive? It's just that the bar has been raised that defines a special occasion.
Okay,
it's
Maxine,
all about context.
Maxine, thank you, Robert.
We shouldn't be just engaging with debates within Christianity. I mean, we can also look at debates within Islam. I've just been to the exhibition on the Hajj.
This is at the British Museum in
which
London.
Is now on at the British Museum. I think we do have to remember the five pillars of Islam. And one of those is the provision that you must give so much of your income every year for providing for the poor, but also to take part in Ramadan, where you experience what it is like to be hungry. There were also very, very firm rules against the display and use of gold at the table. Instead, the Mughals, the whole parts of the Islamic world displayed their fine tableware in the form of porcelain, which they imported from China.
Michael and then Chris.
I was just to pick up on that. I mean, yes. there is a good way of stopping this kind of continuous ramping up of luxurious display. In ancient Athens, they didn't do it with weddings, they did it with funerals. Like all the aristos were having a bigger and better funeral on top of one another. And so the Athenians just sort of put in a whole set of laws, you know, saying you can't have your funeral procession going through the main streets, you can't have it at a certain time of day when everyone will see, you can't have a tomb that takes more than a certain number of workmen a certain number of days to build. And they keep coming back in with this, putting an absolute check on it when it gets out of hand. It's all part of the managing process. And if we don't keep managing it, then it's controlling us rather than us controlling it.
I mean, Chris, do you think you can manage the global appetite for luxury?
No, is the very short answer to that. I mean, we're at a point now where our middle classes in our ascending economies, our BRICS, if you may, is set to double over the next 10 years. So we're looking at a middle class population of in excess of a billion people. It's going to increase by 55 million every year. There simply isn't enough luxury product to go around. I mean, that's the very reason why a canny luxury brand like Hermes, for example, decided not to compete in China, because they looked at their issue to do with productivity and provenance and said, we simply cannot produce enough product for this market. So we will not produce for this market. What they did, which I thought was quite clever, was try and set up what you could say is China's first new luxury brand, which is that it's designed by a Chinese designer, it's marketed for the Chinese consumer, it specializes in traditional Chinese products like lacquer and silk and fine porcelain, and it's reinventing, as it were, and innovating around the idea of what the luxury and money classes in China hopefully will aspire to over and above a traditional European brand.
Giles?
But the dynamic isn't just, you know, keep on going up with regard to luxury, because there's ways of calling it down which are not to do with sort of austerity, but, you know, using the language of flash or vulgar or something like that. So there's a certain way in which you not from a moral perspective but from an aesthetic perspective that you can call down the luxury thing, and suddenly you're seen to be foolish, you know, as you were talking about with the Athenians, and the way in which suddenly there's a way of characterising this and the whole stock collapses.
But listen, let me just say, in the Athenian vocab of luxury, where a word which at one point in time has you know a good connotations ends up being kind of becoming sort of flashy Las Vegas, you know, as it were.
Let me sound like a cavalier for a moment, which is a rare moment in my life. The truth about it is, vulgarity, meaning of the people, of course, from the Latin, is one of those things, isn't it, that people on the rise always are subject to. I always think, I live near Bloomsbury, Virginia Woolf, Charleston. They went for simplicity only because they were so rich. In other words, there is a way, isn't there, in which what counts as vulgar for the arrived is always actually really valuable for those arriving. I'm sorry to sound like a cavalier and disappoint.
Well, of course, you're quite right in this. I mean, my wife loves all that shaker stuff that you can buy. I mean, it's just terribly simple. It comes out of simple living. My word, it's expensive. You know, I mean, it's really expensive. So it's a mark of your, you know, your status and so forth. How simple you... So the whole thing's inverted in very complicated ways.
OK, well, look, we've talked so far about, you know, the ethics. We've talked about the potential democratization. We've talked about how it runs across history. I want us to try to go back, if we can, to what Chris started with when he started mumbling in a useful way, which is when that issue really of it's out of the bag, it's out of the bottle, he's just repeated in a sense, it can't be controlled. What do we do about it now if, you know, the appetite for luxury can't be cooled? It can't be controlled like the Athenians controlled it, partly because they had slaves and women who weren't citizens, so you could do a whole set of things in small city-states you can't do in global economies. What do you do, Chris?
Inflate prices more. Reinstate luxury in terms of price. Prepare for the birth of the gigillionaire. I think one of the issues...
What's a gigillionaire?
Well, got more money than a billionaire. I think you just get ready for the idea that actually luxury is going to really hurt your pocket once more. But I completely also agree that only really works if the product that you're buying, or the experience, indeed, if it's an experience that you're buying, has real value or meaning to you. I went to, I won't name them, a luxury designer store recently to take back a pair of sunglasses that had broken. And previously, when this had happened with another pair, they'd had to get sent back to the factory in Italy to get mended, which always seemed to happen when it was closed, so it took loads of time. But this time, they just looked at them and they came back within 30 seconds and presented me with a brand new pair. And rather than walking out of that store feeling elated or happy, which I think I was supposed to feel, that the customer service was such that, you know, there was this instant return of product, no questions asked, I looked at this box and I thought, so... just how valuable is that product in there that you were able to just give me a new pair in seconds? What was the actual integral value of this product that I thought was worth something, that had been made with an attention to detail and care and craftsmanship and heritage and provenance? And it was lacking in all of those kind of constituent parts that define luxury.
I'll be in tears soon, Chris. I want to come to Giles and then to Robert.
I mean, I think that's a really important story, because I think, you know, I mean, this is the sense in which there is a sort of moral, spiritual crisis at the heart of this going up, that somehow shopping or something can satisfy some of our deepest longings. And there is something about wanting to plug some of the stuff that we ache and hurt for and so forth with all this stuff. And I think, you know, when you tell that story, one of the things that's quite painful about that story is the sort of realisation that what is here is sort of not as good as you thought it was, or not as important, and it doesn't make us feel fundamentally better. So there is a sort of spiritual crisis about constantly, you know, the search for luxury, plugging a hole, plugging an emptiness within us, and the great temples of this are our shopping centres.
And without, I don't want to get us too distracted, but last summer's consumers' riots, do you see, is that how you read them, at least in part?
Well, I think there were many different things that were going on. I mean, you know, to some extent, they were the "because I'm worth it" riots. I mean, there was something about that in them. On the other hand, and this is the way in which it feeds in both directions, they were a cry of anger about, you know, the condition that many people live in and so forth. It's much more complicated than one answer.
Robert, Chris said, just make them more expensive. I know you're interested in taxation, progressive taxation. Is that the solution? We just put a tax on them that makes the tax on good French wine look modest?
I think there is a need to manage luxury consumption. There's an opportunity, in fact, in the willingness to consider doing that. What we know is that all the income growth of the last three decades in the United States, and it's true as well in other countries, has gone to people at the top of the income ladder. That's a very big contrast from the earlier pattern when incomes grew at about the same rate for everybody. And that's what I think has created the riots you saw in the UK last year. People at the top spend more because they have more money. That's not a moral indictment of them, surely. That's what everybody does. When they spend more, the people in their circle who are a little below them spend a little more too. I talked earlier about this expenditure cascade that happens.
Yeah. But if
so,
this
now
is
the
true,
middle class is, yeah, spending more on parties for their kids.
But if I understand what you're saying, Robert, that's to pull against what Chris was saying, because if you up the price via taxation on these goods, they become more expensive. That simply ups the bar of what you have to pay for them.
No. Okay. It doesn't have that effect at all. And also, you don't want to tax specific products. That's what societies have tried to do in the past. And if you put the legislature to the task of deciding what's a luxury and what's not, it's so easy for people to invent new things to focus on as luxuries. You don't want to do that. Every time that's been attempted, it's failed because of people's ingenuity at inventing new luxuries that aren't taxed.
Okay.
What you want to do is tax the total amount people spend at steeply progressive rates. You take your income, report that to the tax authorities, then report how much you saved during the year to the tax authorities. We already know how to do that. The difference between those two numbers, your income minus your savings, that's how much you spent during the year.
Okay, Maxine.
And tax that at a very steeply progressive rate, and people will have an incentive to spend less than $10 million on a coming-of-age party.
That's when you don't sound like an American. Maxine?
I just want to go back to Chris's longing for the craftsmanship, the attention to detail, the skill in the making of his sunglasses. I think we can also look at this historically. Much of the debate about luxury in the 18th century was a debate over people who were bringing in goods from afar. Those goods were invested with magic and exoticism, and especially the fact that they could not be made in Europe. Until the later Middle Ages, the silks of China were still the best that could be had, and we have a bit of a problem with this. We know now many of those goods were not made by individual craftsmen.
Okay. Well, then
they were made in big factories.
I've never had anything against factory goods, but I want us, if we could at this moment, and that's helpful what Maxine said, just we went earlier today to interview the French director of the new Cartier. And now this Cartier ad, which you will see at a cinema near you, is an extraordinary, in fact, ad is not what it is, short film is what it is. And it is in its way a fine film. It's got a live panther in it because a panther is the logo of Cartier. It starts in Paris and ends in China. It's luxuriant, it's bejeweled. And when I met Bruno Avayon, I asked him why Cartier had briefed him to end up in China.
A lot of people, they really believe that the first intention of Cartier was to target their new consumer, which we know they are Russia and China, India and Brazil. What is interesting is the first intention was not this for them. It was more to create an homage and to about their own history. Because they provide amazing jewelry for the Tsar in Russia, and they have a fantastic collection inspired by China culture, and etc. So for them, it was more about an homage and to show to people their own history. People know Cartier as a brand and or as a logo, but they don't know necessarily what is the background, and the background is very rich. But of course, by coincidence, this history fit perfectly with the changing of the new world and the way the world is moving now today. You know, we know that, especially in China, India, there is new consumer for this kind of luxury, and it's very interesting to see that how it fits.
That was Bruno Avayon, the director of a new Cartier short film or ad. This issue that actually luxury goods are somehow exotic. You know, and sometimes they can come, as Maxine said, from another culture. Was that true in ancient Athens, that goods from faraway places had a kind of luxurious cachet about them?
Absolutely. I mean, nowhere clearer than in recently there was an exhibition at the Ashmolean Museum, which was about the Macedonian kings. And there were two fantastic, beautifully preserved ostrich eggs. Now, that's simply a fact. There ain't no ostriches in Greece. And it's not just about the fact that it's travelled that far. It's about the fact that you, as the king, the owner, had the ability to affect a relationship over that distance to bring it that far. It's about your status and your relationship with other potentates around the ancient world that makes distance and exoticness so important.
And do you think, Chris, to do with China, India, Russia and Brazil, the BRIC countries, do you think the fact that the luxury goods on the whole are largely not made there, and you're right, Hermes is the exception to the rule, partly gives them that quality, that aura?
It does now, yes, currently. Because we also know that they're not just buying them at home, of course, they're buying them when they come abroad. So you speak to any of the store managers, for example, on any of the big shopping streets in Europe, and you'll very quickly discover who's actually buying their product in the UK, in France, in Germany and Spain. And it's not the home market. It's those that travel abroad in order to shop. And so that sense, I think, of the journey, and it is the experience as well as the purchase. Let's not forget it. It isn't just a nice emotional kind of package. It is that desire, that very straightforward desire for status and acquisition, for something that you can take back home and show to people or to gift, that brings with it the luxury and the allure that comes from that brand.
Yeah. If you inspire that desire, which after all is what the Cartier ad and others, how do you control it?
That's a very good question. I think, well, the issue is obviously if you're a luxury brand at the moment and you're one of the large European conglomerates, you don't, and you've actually got a business that's rampant and that's actually out of control. I mean, you know, you're experiencing double-digit growth and you actually don't know how to satisfy your market, such as the rapacious demand. You're about to run out of product, or in fact, you do run out of product before Christmas. And this is the problem, but this is the problem of consumerism. It's not a problem of the luxury industry. This is the basic model of consumption we have, which is no longer sustainable. It's not fit for purpose.
OK, come on, Cavalier Fraser.
Well, no, I'm not feeling in a cavalier mood when I hear that. I mean, I'm not. It's very difficult to defend, isn't it? I mean, you know, the whole thing is that it pulls in both ways. I mean, the idea that we live in a world which is, you know, undergoing a sort of, you know, economic crisis in all areas of life, and actually the one area that's taking off is luxury goods. It says something about who we are as human beings and what our needs are and what we're yearning for. I mean, and the idea that we're trying to sort of get something through these objects that actually is, it's not about their function, it's not even perhaps about their status, it's about our fundamental insecurity.
You really believe that, Robert?
Definitely.
It does say those things, but it also, more importantly, says that the distribution of income has shifted dramatically. It's really much more about that, I believe. I think we're reading and writing about luxury much more now because all the income growth of the last three decades has gone essentially to the top 1%. And if you look within the top 1%, most of it's gone to the top 0.1%. So,
but even
so
if
those
that
are the things we notice, the things they buy.
I understand that, Robert, but the truth is the women queuing in Canton Road in Hong Kong are not necessarily that top 1%. The interesting issue, isn't it, is these are aspirational goods.
Exactly. It's been the cascade that's been launched by the spending of the top 1% that we're seeing, and that's ended up being what's put the middle-class families in debt. They can't afford to buy bigger houses. Their wages haven't gone up in the last 30 years, but if you don't spend more on a house, if you're the middle earner, then your house ends up being the one in the bad school catchment area. Your kids go to the bad school. So you've got to keep pace with what others are spending.
I want, as we're coming to the end, and I'm afraid we are coming to the end now, to ask you all the desert island asteroid question. Maxine, what luxury do you take on a desert asteroid, if such a place exists?
I would choose a good book to read, something that might relate to aesthetics, taste, and the civilized way of life, which is about providing for greater education and museums, libraries, in a new direction.
To look, not to buy. Michael, and then Giles.
Well, there's one famous book that you might take with you is the Odyssey, Homer's Odyssey, right? And there the character Odysseus, the guy who's had it all, been everywhere, done it all, lost it all again, got it back. He talks about what his greatest luxury, what his greatest pleasure is, and it turns out to be a good dinner with good wine and good friends. And, you know, we can get caught up all the time in talking about objects, but let's try and remember a bigger perspective that there are some other really important things in life, and let's keep aiming for them as well. That would
Robert?
Be my dinner.
Yeah, I too would want to bring an interesting person with me, somebody I could talk to. That's the greatest luxury, is to have the company of an interesting person.
Giles?
It's all a bit so worthy. So that's the problem. It doesn't feel like luxury to me. Just feel like all that sort of museums and people.
I'd bring my Porsche Boxster S with me if there were any roads on this asteroid.
I'd claret. Expensive claret.
Seems reasonable for a Church of England vicar. I always thought the cavaliers never rounded. And the final word goes to Chris.
I would agree, but I'd be a bit specific. So I'd like a case of 1985 Chateau Latour, because I can take the wine out of the box and then I can break up the box and put it alight and hopefully signal for somebody to come join me.
Listen, on that note, I'm afraid we have to end. Thank you very much to Chris Sanderson, to Michael Scott, to Maxine Berg, to Giles Fraser, and down the line from America to Robert Frank. Thank you all very much indeed.